alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
The spotlight.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Meanwhile, the Taliban has marked its first-year anniversary of foreign and American troops exiting with flags and chants in central Kabul, while residents rejoice that peace has come despite the deteriorating economic situation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the U.S.'s longest war and why its intervention was a failure, as stated by their own general. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Brian Terrell joins us. He's a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa. Also joining us, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Brian Terrell. When you have a U.S. general, and it's a sobering assessment, say, quote, outcomes in a war like this, an outcome that is a strategic failure, the enemy is in charge in Kabul, there's no way else to describe that, that the outcome is a cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days. The fact that he's saying that, that it is a failure, what does that say about this war altogether?
Well, I would question whether it was a failure or not. The failure... That presupposes that winning the war was ever something that was contemplated or even desired. As Julian Assange said back in 2011, I think, that the purpose of this war was to wash money out of the U.S. and European tax bases through Afghanistan into the hands of the transnational security elite. And as that, it's been very successful. These, billions and billions of dollars have disappeared, but they have not disappeared into thin air. They've gone into some people's pockets. And it's been it's done that quite successfully. And it does not bode well because we're continuing to foment more of these wars. And the money keeps rolling in for Raytheon and Boeing and such.
So who's making off with this money? How does that transpire? Can you give us a short version of how that happens?
Well, the Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, is formerly member of the Board of Directors for Raytheon Technologies. This was a great deal from the beginning for Dick Cheney and his investments during that time. I had the opportunity to visit Afghanistan. I was there seven times from 2009 to 2018. And each visit, I saw the situation deteriorate. My last visits, I would be the only Westerner leaving the airport after deplaning and going through immigration, because everybody else was going from getting on a helicopter and going to another armed compound. It was getting more and more dangerous and devolving. During that time, the United States, not the war expenses, but on the so-called reconstruction, spent more money. More money was spent reconstruction of Afghanistan than the entire Marshall Plan at the end of World War II that rebuilt the cities of Western Europe, and saw nothing of that. The only roads that were paved were between the military bases, and the only housing, you know, was the hospitals were getting worse. I'd visit the hospitals. They were getting, you know, the schools, everything was getting worse the whole time, every time. And the compounds where the elite lived, the oligarchs lived, they were improved. And the
Sure. Let's see what Daniel Lazar thinks about this. Daniel Lazar, you heard our guest there. Lots of money not going for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, billions of dollars. That puts another light on this whole situation. Not that it wasn't known before. Who do you think made out with all this money?
Well, it wasn't billions. It was trillions. It was an astonishing sum. And yes, it went to the arms manufacturers, the contractors, various NGOs, and countless other parasites who wound up making small fortunes off this entire misadventure. But I would emphasize that it wasn't merely a get-rich scheme. The America completely lost its way. Its imperial doctrine utterly failed after 9/11. And one reason is that America was unable to admit that the country that was most responsible for that attack was Saudi Arabia. Because if America had admitted that, it would have had to essentially break relations with Riyadh and completely reconstruct or rethink its entire military presence in the Persian Gulf region. So rather than do that, America chose to blame everybody else that it possibly could. Instead of Riyadh. I mean, it blamed Iran, it blamed Afghanistan, it blamed Saddam Hussein, it blamed everyone. And the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq were just fantastic misadventures. I mean, just America really went crazy and really behaved in a way that was utterly irrational, even by imperialist standards, and empires often behave quite irrationally. And so the U.S. really blundered into a quagmire. It had no way of winning and never really had thought of even tried to define what meaning might even mean. And so as a result, it ran through trillions, left the country in worse shape than when it arrived, brought nothing but poverty and suffering, and now has left Afghanistan to its own devices while seizing something like $7 billion in Afghan overseas deposits. So it's just a colossal scandal, no matter how you look at it.
Indeed. One of the things there, Brian Terrell, that our guest Daniel Lazar mentioned, is the fact that they didn't know what they were doing. I'd like to expand a little bit more on that with you, because the reports that have indicated and have confirmed the fact that senior U.S. officials actually failed to tell the truth when it came to what was happening there and about the performance throughout this 20-year occupation that happened there. They actually made rosy announcements about what was going on there. They were hiding the facts and the evidence that this war had become unwinnable. But they were presenting another side to that story, a false side, that they were successful. This lying that they did was happening for a long time. Why is it then that nothing was done about the prevention of the lies, but more so for them to find a solution to improve what was going on there, because the occupation continued, even though reports came out that they had lied about it.
Well, there's a long history of this in the Vietnam War. Of course, we have the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg released, telling that the rosy story that General Westmoreland and the presidents Nixon and Johnson were portraying were lies. Way back then, and there have been leakers, WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning, people have had the courage to speak up. And what was happening to them is the punishment of the ones who told the truth. Another general who should be mentioned is General Stanley McChrystal, who was under Obama was the head of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, and he made the mistake of having a telling the truth interview with Rolling Stone magazine, and he said back then that this was unwinnable and that he was. What he said, for every innocent Afghan who's killed, the United States is creating 10 new enemies. And of course, President Obama got his job. He was demoted. He was fired for telling the truth. So the truth has been out there. The U.S. media has been very complicit in trying to silence that truth. This is not something, it's these having these generals today come out as like, who knew we were losing? Who knew that this was a waste? It really is disingenuous. I think this was something that we knew from the beginning. And in the beginning too,
let me come to you, Daniel Lazar. I think we may have lost. I'm sorry, we lost connection with you, Brian Terrell, for a second. This is what's very confusing, Daniel Lazar, and I'd like to find out from you if you have an answer. Back in 2015, Douglas Lute is a 3-star Army general who served in the position of what's called the White House's Afghan War Czar during the Bush and Obama administration. This is what he has said. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan, and this is the part that's really shocking. We didn't know what we were doing. He says, what are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking. I'm trying to really digest that. How do you go into another country and then not know what you're doing there?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. It's very hard to understand. But remember, first of all, that after 9/11, America had to invade someone, and its primary target was Saddam Hussein in Iraq. However, the Democrats thought that was ridiculous because Al-Qaeda had a certain presence in Afghanistan. And in fact, its chief, Osama bin Laden, was actually physically located in Afghanistan. So to oblige the Democrats to satisfy their concerns, the Bush administration invaded Afghanistan. But it really invaded Afghanistan merely to show that it could invade Afghanistan using a very small force and using various allies on the ground to overthrow the regime. And that operation was highly successful. Highly successful. But the next day arrived and America had no idea what to do. It hadn't given any thought as to what it would do with this immense country of 40 million people once it succeeded in toppling the Taliban. So therefore, they spent 20 years dithering, in utter confusion, knowing nothing about the country itself, knowing nothing about what the goal should be, what America was doing there, anything like that. So that's what we saw. And I might add, by the way, that one of the great champions of the Afghan invasion was Joe Biden, who at the time was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a major figure in U.S. foreign policy formulation. And what was Joe Biden's punishment? Obviously, there was no punishment. He was rewarded by being, transported into the White House, where he then was able to preside over this utter defeat that America suffered last August. It's really bonkers.
so many things here that just boggles the mind, Brian Terrell. One of them is something that actually the U.S. wants to boast that it does when it intervenes illegally in some sense into other nations. But many U.S. officials have acknowledged that Afghanistan's, that the U.S. purpose there was to remake it into a modern nation, okay? So that to me gives the notion of nation building in a sense. Now, this is what Obama stated after the U.S.-backed NATO invasion of Libya about his worst mistake. He said, probably failing to plan for the day after, okay, what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya. Did the U.S. think this through in terms of militarily coming in, but then what it is going to do to, in this case, rebuild the nation or to move towards nation building?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think that presupposes that's actually what they wanted to do. And I think whatever the motives that someone like Obama or Biden might personally have had, the idea that if you repeat a mistake over and over and over again, repeat it in Vietnam, repeat it in Libya, repeat it in Afghanistan, repeat it, Honduras, repeat it in the list could go on and on. It's a sign of a criminal pattern. It's not good, well-intentioned people making mistakes over and over and over again. The same mistakes happened, and again with from the beginning of this, from President Carter starting to arm the Mujahideen. There were always people. There were always experts. There were always people saying, "Don't do it. Don't do it." As we're seeing in Europe now. From 1993, there were people, anybody knowing anything about the situation in Europe saying NATO cannot expand. We're not going to expand NATO. Even Joe Biden warned in 1993, warned that expanding NATO was going to provoke Russia. And look where we are. It's not a progression of the same mistakes over and over and over again is a pattern of criminality. If these people are, if these are truly mistakes, and perhaps they are, then we're being ruled by and have been ruled for decades by a government that is absolutely incapable, inept, unable to govern itself, much less trying to export itself, the idea that the United States today is trying to rebuild other nations while our own infrastructure is falling apart, while our own education and our roads and everything that makes for a decent life. The life expectancy of Americans is going down for the first time while we're spending more than $1 trillion on extending the life of our nuclear weapons, which are clearly illegal under all these international laws that we're party to. There may be good intentions there, but the good intentions are not. It shows how little good intentions count.
Well, I mean, to even wrap our thoughts around this is so difficult, Daniel Lazar. The U.S. government is cited by a Washington Post report that came out a few years back, in which it interviewed 400 or 500 military personnel. One of the things that it came out with was said that it deliberately misled the public, that it was common, it said, to distort statistics to make it appear that the U.S. was actually winning the war. So you're lying to the American people, you're lying to the world, really, after you spend all this money. But the way of going about lying is what I'm questioning here. When you come and you distort numbers, and you mislead the public in that way, that's incredible, right? And then it's still happening because after Afghanistan, there are other wars now. I mean, we're looking at somewhat Ukraine, or somewhat for the U.S. to be involved in the Ukraine conflict. What is your impression of the U.S. going about it that way?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct. It really is mind-boggling. But you've got to remember, let's go back to 9/11. The U.S. had invested literally trillions of dollars in militarizing the Persian Gulf and strengthening the Saudi regime. And what it got for its efforts on September 11th, 2001, was death and destruction on an unprecedented scale in lower Manhattan. So American policies had blown up in its face. Now, that's in any kind of honest government, that would have meant a massive reanalysis, reconceptualization, rethink of where U.S. Middle East policy was going. But that was the last thing Washington wanted to do or was even capable of doing. So as a result, America engaged in these completely eccentric, willfully, absurd actions, whose purpose was to, number one, lie to the American people about the, what had happened on 9/11. Number two, to sort of demonstrate that, to flex its military muscle, to show it was still a tough guy. And number three, to knock over some unfriendly regimes in the Middle East, beginning with the Taliban in Afghanistan and then culminating with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And by the way, if the war in Iraq had been successful, the U.S. then had a list of something like five other countries it was planning to invade, including Iran. Now, this was complete madness. It was nothing more than a gigantic temper tantrum. And it led to disaster. And it just goes to show how completely broken the American political leadership really is, and the political leadership in both parties. I mean, the American government operates in a bubble. It has little understanding of the world at large, little understanding of how to conduct itself relative to the world at large, and is just careening out of control, creating disaster wherever it goes. I mean, Afghanistan was a start, but it's not the end by any means.
Well, I was trying to figure out, Brian Terrell, how much money the U.S. is spending on its involvement with the conflict in Ukraine. And I'm going to go out on a limb and ask this question if you think that my thinking here is either correct or completely out of line in a sense. You know, you have this 20-year occupation war that ended, and the fiasco that it was, and even the way it ended was a fiasco. And now that that's ended, we are seeing, about 6 months into the Ukraine conflict, we're seeing how the U.S. Is spending money. Few hundred million dollars a day is one estimate, but if you take a look at the bigger picture, it's billions of dollars. Are we looking at a pattern where there needs to be a war for the U.S. government to flow cash into it? And based on the past, like Afghanistan, there are people who are making out that are profiting from this, hence that war, the term war profiteering, which is coined from the U.S., basically, is showing itself again. Is this a pattern? That we're seeing here?
Well, yes, it is. The United States at this point, we really don't have any other product. We don't have anything to offer. Everything that we have you go in a department store in the United States and everything is made in China, or our clothing comes from Guatemala. It's all, it's the import that the export that we have is weapons, and it's the mainstay of our economy. We're in we don't have anything else to offer the world right now that anybody wants. I think we're also dealing with climate change and a frantic effort to maintain the control over fossil fuels instead of looking for alternatives. The biggest part of the budget for the Department of Energy for the United States is developing nuclear weapons. It's not looking for renewable alternatives to fossil fuel. It's not looking for independence. It's looking for control of other people's oil.
Okay.
While we build more weapons.
Thank you very much for that, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist. Brian Terrell, thank you so much, political commentator and peace activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikava Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فجمع السحرة لميقات يوم معلوم
So the magicians were assembled for the appointment of a well-known day.
وَقِيلَ لِلنَّاسِ هَلْ أَنْتُمْ مُجْتَمِعُونَ
And it was said to the people, Will you congregate?
لَعَلَّنَا نَتَّبِعُ السَّحَرَةَ إِن كَانُوا هُمُ الْغَالِبِينَ
That we might follow the magicians if they are the predominant.
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we reached the 39th verse of chapter Shu'ara. وَقِيلَ لِلنَّاسِ هَلْ أَنْتُمْ مُجْتَمِعُونَ And it was said to people, Will you assemble? This was the continuation of the conversation and somehow the fight between the side of Moses and his brother Aaron and that of Pharaoh and his companions. Moses showed up a miracle, they did not believe in it, and they considered it as a wizardry and sorcery. So they asked all the skillful sorcerers and wizards of Egypt to come and gather in one appointment of a day well known, as the verse says, فَجُمِعَ السَّحَرَةُ لِمِيقَاتِ يَوْمٍ مَعْلُومٍ in order to fight and defeat Moses and to defend the side of Pharaoh. Moses was sure that he will be victorious in this fight. So he chose a specific occasion, which was the one of the feasts of Egyptians. And Moses knew that he is going to be victorious. So he wanted the light of faith to be shining in more hearts of the people of society. So the verse implies that people were also invited to attend this struggling, as it declares, وَقِيلَ لِلنَّاسِ هَلْ أَنْتُمْ مُجْتَمِعُونَ And it was said to the people, Will you assemble? As we said, it is very important to the legitimate rulers and oppressors of each time to attract the people's opinion, to have the people gathered in every scene because they want their propaganda going on. This statement of this verse, the 39th verse, shows that Pharaoh's officers did their jobs very calculately. They knew that if they forced people to attend the gathering, they might react negatively. So they declared that if they were willing to attend it, they could do it. Certainly, such a way of speaking attracted more people to that event and gathering, and the people and companions of Pharaoh were so experts in inviting people. Let's move on to the next verse after a short break.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, continuing the previous verse, the 40th one says, لَعَلَّنَا نَتَّبِعُ السَّحَرَةَ إِنْ كَانُوا هُمُ الْغَالِبِينَ. Haply we may follow the sorcerers if they are victors. So, in that event, Moses and Aaron were standing alone on one side because they had faith, and Pharaoh, all rich people and wizards were standing on the other side. They were truly worried. Here, the role of faith and its power gets truly clear. Moses had that determination and he was sure that he has Allah with him. So, anyway, these companions of Pharaoh told the people that their aim was that if their sorcerers became victorious, whose victory was the victory of their gods, they would follow them, and they promised to treat so enthusiastically that the enemies of their gods would perish forever. The verse says, لَعَلَّنَا نَتَّبِعُ السَّحَرَةَ إِنْ كَانُوا هُمُ الْغَالِبِينَ. That we may follow the sorcerers if they are victors. So they wanted the people to warm up the gathering so that the enemies of their gods would be defeated totally. It is very clear that the considerable presence of fans and supporters who advocate one party is both to boost morale and to provide hope and assurance. It also causes them to try their best. When their team succeeds, they can make such noise in the advantage of their team that their contending party will go to seclusion, and they can frighten the opposite party from the beginning of the struggle. So imagine these aims. Pharaoh's officers wanted to call people to the gathering. Moses, alayhi nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, also asked Allah such presence of people so that he could achieve his aim in the best way. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Reza Khan was not himself perhaps opposed to hold morning session. He was an agent assigned to stop them. He was assigned by experts who knew the issue well. Those were enemies of us, all of Muslim nations. They had studied the circumstances of the nations and knew that they could not reach their aims as long as such morning sessions and recitation of elegies were held and the cruelties of rulers were revealed and condemned.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. In the name of Allah, we start another episode of the program Spring of Truth. Welcome, my dear brothers and sisters in faith. And if you've been following us, you probably know that in the, you know, these series of programs, we're trying to choose some of the wise sayings of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and try to offer you an explanation about it, hoping that it would be fruitful for your everyday lives. So the one that I have chosen today is, he says, just as every person, an individual, is obliged to correct himself, he's also obliged to correct others. This is really tricky. You have to think about it in order to know exactly what he means. Because so many people, they focus all their attention on fixing other people, assuming that whatever they're doing is right, and all their attention, all their energy is on other people. On the other hand, some other people believe that they have to focus all their energy and attention on themselves, and they say that, you know, it's a free world, I'll try to do whatever I can do, I'm going to be the best version of myself, and, you know, I don't really care about other people and what they do and how they live, I only care about myself.
صلى الله عليه وسلم يا رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
there should be a balance between the two, and not to be so immersed in yourself and also focusing on yourself at the same time, you know, not being carefree about other people in your society. It's actually what he's trying to say is the idea of amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, to order to the right and forbid from the wrong. But of course, this very important principle in Islam has its conditions. And if you want to have an effect, if you want to have an impact on other people in doing amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, you have to first work on yourself. I mean, you can't say something that you're not good at. You know, you can't actually order people to what is right when you're not doing it yourself. I remember a beautiful hadith. Someone came to the Prophet and said that, please tell my child not to eat so much dates. And then the Prophet said, not today, I can't do that because I have eaten dates today myself. So you see, there are some detailed and some very sensitive points to the amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar that you have to keep in mind in order to be effective in what you're trying to say. So if you want to do it, first of all, work on yourself and don't be an example of the verse that says some people, some knowledgeable people are just like donkeys carrying books where they themselves do not practice upon. Thank you very much for being with us and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al Masila, at a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. This systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemenis suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations.
As Yemenis face a fuel crash due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of three British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers.
An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality.
Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across, and that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters, but choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Mevlut
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
CGTN think tank showed that the China Global Television Network and Chinese Public Opinion Institute have conducted a survey in Afghanistan and 24 global countries to assess the 20-year American war on Afghanistan.
Now, the Taliban will pay a price.
At the beginning of its presence in Afghanistan, the U.S. made a commitment to build a stable, strong, and prosperous Afghanistan, claiming it would establish democracy, fight against terrorism, and rebuild the nation. Nearly 79% of the Afghan respondents polled said the U.S. did not keep its promise, while 80% termed the U.S. war in their country a complete failure.
The U.S. never abided by its promises. Current disasters in Afghanistan have all resulted from the U.S. failures. We would witness better days today if the U.S. hadn't occupied our country. 20 years ago, the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan, and today they have control again. So what did the years of U.S. war and huge expenses change in our country? The U.S. claimed to bring prosperity in Afghanistan. Instead, it destroyed everything.
During the war, Afghanistan faced severe challenges with regards to security, economy, and people's livelihoods. Some 56.6% of Afghan respondents said the U.S. left the Afghan economy worse than it was in 2001. Yet 80% of global respondents believe that the causes of local terrorism still exist in the war-ravaged country.
I've been in Afghanistan through the U.S. invasion. I agree with the results of the poll. The U.S. came to our country claiming to counter terrorism and help the Afghan economy grow, but practically none of them materialized. The U.S. institutionalized fraud and abuse. As a result, today Afghans don't have food to eat and terrorism threats are rising.
Meanwhile, 68% of the respondents said the U.S. war in Afghanistan has caused the U.S. to continue to lose its credibility with the international community. Some 65% of those surveyed in Afghanistan said they believe neighboring countries, including Iran, Pakistan, and China, play a key role in the rebuilding of the war-battered nation. 70% of global respondents described Washington seizing Afghanistan's assets as pure looting. They called on the U.S. to return Afghans' money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Biri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shiite cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed, and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light, that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life, life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men ordered a flight to Italy on August 31st. But al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
The Iranian Foreign Minister's short-notice visit to Russia carries major messages, as it comes at a time when Tehran is carefully examining the recent U.S. draft response to the 2015 deal, which holds Russia as one of its signatories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was warmly greeted in Moscow on Wednesday by his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The Russian foreign minister once again reaffirmed his country's support for a fair deal or no deal.
The Russian Federation shares the same stances as Iran towards the 2015 deal. We believe that the U.S.'s illegal sanctions against Iran must be removed to save the deal.
Meanwhile, Tehran and Washington are currently exchanging comments on the European Union's new draft proposal for the revival of what is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has repeatedly said it wants a sustainable accord, which includes guarantees that would make the deal immune to any possible withdrawal by the U.S. administration.
My colleagues are thoroughly reviewing the American text. We seek stronger and more reliable guarantees from the U.S. to prevent any future withdrawal from the deal by the U.S. government.
The 2015 deal was cast into limbo in 2018 when Washington unilaterally walked out of the accord and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Iran, in return, scaled back some of its commitments to the pact, saying it will return to its obligations only after the U.S. removes all anti-Iran sanctions. The Vienna talks over the revival of the accord have faced a hiatus over the past 5 months. The discussions are now set to resume after Iran approves and accepts the U.S. draft response. The Iranian foreign minister's visit to Moscow is of great significance, since Russia is a key player in the 2015 deal and shares